Does cybersecurity seem like a terrifying topic? Well, have no fear. This episode is sponsored by Roundtable Technology, the nonprofit IT partner. For the eighth year in a row, they are offering a free webinar to teach you and your staff exactly the steps to make your IT more secure in the new year. Head over to nonprofitit.com/best-ever to save your seat. Roundtable Technology is a managed IT and cybersecurity services organization focusing almost exclusively on the nonprofit sector with over 200 nonprofit clients. So make it your New Year's resolution to get your entire staff free cybersecurity awareness training. Go to nonprofitit.com/best-ever to save your seat now. And here's to a wonderful 2024. Hello, and welcome to Nonprofit Nation. I'm your host, Julia Campbell, and I'm going to sit down with nonprofit industry experts, fundraisers, marketers, and everyone in between to get real and discuss what it takes to build that movement that you've been dreaming of. I created the Nonprofit Nation podcast to share practical wisdom and strategies to help you confidently find your voice, definitively grow your audience, and effectively build your movement. If you're a nonprofit newbie or an experienced professional who's looking to get more visibility, reach more people, and create even more impact, then you're in the right place. Let's get started. Hi, everyone. Welcome and welcome back to Nonprofit Nation. I'm your host, Julia Campbell, and I am happy to be here with you today, wherever you're listening. Now, the topic that we're discussing today is how to double your revenue using bold thinking. Now, we know that nonprofits are often stuck in the status quo of fundraising, like inching along towards revenue goals and slashing programs and budgets along the way. But what if we changed the question to, what if we had no choice but to double our revenue over the next 3 years with half the resources, half the human effort, half the budget? How would we do it? That's the question that my guest aims to answer. Matt Scott is CEO of Cosmic and the author of The High Growth Nonprofit, Proven Steps to Quickly Double Your Revenue and Drive Impact. And during Matt's 7 years at Team Rubicon, he took the organization from $275,000 in annual revenue to $51 million. That is a lot. It's a huge revenue jump. So Matt, tell us a little bit about you and how you got into nonprofit work.
Yeah, Julia, thanks so much for having me on the show. I'll leave a caveat that I was a part of a group effort to make that revenue growth happen, but I appreciate the nod.
You do say that in the book. You say that it was a team effort, but it was definitely due to some of the bold strategies that I think we're going to talk about today.
Yeah, so I got into the nonprofit space really because I was intrigued by this intersection of kind of leveraging my background in like business for doing some good in the world. And I helped build an English learning program in East Los Angeles for undocumented immigrants. And as a part of my kind of senior project in community-based learning, this approach towards applying your education towards doing some good in the community. And it was sort of like at that moment that I just got hooked on how can we leverage best-in-class for-profit methods to apply them to the nonprofit space. And I got a call from a friend of mine, Joanne, who was the first full-time employee at Team Rubicon, the nonprofit that you mentioned. And I had worked with her at the Center for Service and Action in LA. And she said, hey, we're doing something cool. I think you should get over here and help out. And I thought it was a really cool opportunity and left the nonprofit I was at to pounce on it. And that's really how I got into the space.
So now you lead Cosmic. So tell me about the work that you do with this agency, your Portland-based consultancy.
Yeah, so we think of ourselves as growth consultants for nonprofits. So we focus on four key areas, really around strategy, helping to develop an actionable strategic plan for real growth, and operationalizing that strategy, technology, how to implement best-in-class tech to grow, impact and revenue. We also focus on marketing and fundraising as our two other pillars, and those are really around things like website redesigns, integrated marketing programs, and fundraising can span really all audiences, corporate, foundation, major donor, and mass market.
That's great. So in this book, it's called The High Growth Nonprofit, and you sent me a copy. Thank you so much for that. You talk about the importance, and I do believe in this, of shifting our mindset from that of incremental growth to one of exponential growth. And can you share an example of this in action?
Absolutely. Yeah. We ask this question of most of our clients when we're starting out. And one of them that comes to mind is actually a nonprofit here in Portland called Mercy Corps. And they're a $500 million a year nonprofit. So very large nonprofit. They approached us because only about 10% of their revenue comes from unrestricted giving. So they approached us with a goal of trying to grow unrestricted giving. And when we asked them, what was their goal? What was their goal in doing that? They had a 20% drop in a single year in unrestricted giving. They described to us that their goal was, Adrian, their chief development and marketing officer, Adrian described to us that her goal was to increase new unrestricted revenue by 5% each year for the next 3 years. We were like, whoa, you know, just calling out that with incremental growth mindset, you really don't have to do anything differently. You can do exactly what you're currently doing, just a little better, and achieve 5% growth each year. So we gathered their leadership team in a room and we asked them that question, what would we do if we had no choice but to double our revenue with half the resources over the next 3 years? And what this does is it forces, you know, bold thinking and innovation and prioritization. And then the unthinkable happened. Mercy Corps came upon some very bad news. Some 30 years prior, one of the co-founders of the organization was actually abusing children and the board knew about it and failed to act. None of those people, you know, belong to the organization any longer. But Adrian called up and said, gosh, I'm really concerned about what to do here. Staff is upset and we're worried that we're going to lose donors and it's going to impact our ability to, you know, fundraise around the world. And of course, we're very troubled for the victims. And I said, you know, we captured what to do in this moment on that single page, on that one page strategic plan. You know what to do, lean into those three key strategic objectives. And despite this crazy news story, despite this uncertainty, Mercy Corps grew unrestricted revenue from $38 million to $70 million in that year. So instead of looking at that incremental growth mindset, they reimagined how they could approach philanthropy. And they took bold, calculated risks that I really don't think they would have identified as possible had they kind of stayed within the optimization mindset. So that's just one example that comes to mind.
I think that a lot of organizations, they do get stuck in this mindset because they might not be in crisis mode, or they might be in, you know, they might be sort of treading water, but not completely drowning. So how can we really convince organizations to embrace this, you know, exponential growth mindset if it's sort of, you know, kind of like it's just status quo right now?
Yeah, totally. It's a common problem. There's more to do than time to do it. We were just kind of chatting ourselves about this as, you know, small business owners and nonprofit professionals, a kind of similar battle. I think that one of the things we take people through is a prioritization exercise. I think it's pretty key because every organization has limited resources, even Mercy Corps. When trying to get them to determine what are three key markets to focus on, it was really challenging. They wanted to be everywhere, but they didn't have the budget to be everywhere. Really. So figuring out and identifying where are their overlaps in their content pillars, their existing donor base, their staff, what differentiates them from everyone else, that was a way to narrow in. So how to prioritize what to do. It's a simple exercise, but just literally create a list of all the things that you want to do and draw up a grid, a four block grid, and you have impact and effort on the Y and X axis. And essentially, priority one items are high impact, low effort, or low cost, time or money. And
like calling, you know, a donor.
Yeah, like calling a donor. Low cost, thank you for that example.
High impact. Yeah.
Totally. Yeah, exactly. versus like a high impact, high cost might be implementing a new technology, like implementing HubSpot or something, right? Like, yeah, that might have a big impact on revenue, but it's going to cost a lot of money. You can only have so many, you know, priority two projects at one time. What you should do is just eliminate anything that is level four, which is low impact on revenue, high effort. Boom, eliminate those things. Eliminate the things that are low impact on revenue, but low effort, because those aren't worth doing either. You really want to focus on those priority ones and then pick within your priority two projects, begin to identify those even further, go through the metrics again and say, okay, which of these are the highest impact, lower effort against each other? And then that will give you a sense of what are like the three big projects that you could take on this year and which ones should you ignore. That will help you to give clear direction to like your volunteers or your staff. You know, I think we all have helped a friend move at one point or another in our lives. And you know how it is when you show up at a friend's house and like you and six other people are there, but there's no plan. There's like, it's just sort of like, it's not moving ready.
Oh no, drives me crazy.
Totally. Yeah. So that's like an example of how it feels, I think, for volunteer-led organizations or boards. Like they're eager to help, but they don't really know how. So it's the executive director or CEO's job to say, okay, this is the priority and this is where I need you to focus. And I think that that's just a way to prioritize all the things that need to be done. Yeah. So that's just an example.
Is that part of the one-page strategic plan? Because you talk about the power of a one-page strategic plan in the book.
Totally. Yeah, the one-page strategic plan, in our view, and kind of what we include in it is really what's the growth goal? And then who is going to help you get there? Like, who's your target audience? Who are you going after? And then what are you going to do? What are like those key strategies? So it's absolutely inclusive of that. It's how do you define what those key strategies are? Well, you have to prioritize them based on impact and effort. Yeah. And then you kind of identify where, like I talked about with Mercy Corps, three key markets. If you're a local nonprofit, try to get as specific as possible. Where are those people, those audiences? Where do they hang out? Where do they live? And get specific as possible. So yeah, those are just some of the things, but how you define what goes on that OPSP, I think is really important to prioritize.
What would you say to an organization? This is something I hear all the time because I do marketing, that we have 20 different audiences that we need to reach.
I think you're probably asking that because you know how unrealistic and challenging that is. It's really hard, right? Like I'll use Cosmic as an example, right? People ask us, what exactly, who do we focus on? We focus on West Coast-based, mid-sized nonprofits that are left-leaning. And it's very specific, you know? And people are like, well, what about all those other nonprofits? You know? And okay, but it's really hard to speak to everybody. The problems that a large nonprofit and a really small nonprofit, you've already pointed out some of those, they're different. And so a nonprofit similarly has to pick who is most likely to support their mission, who connects with that big vision, who is moved by that. And if you try and target 20 audiences all at once, you're going to end up speaking to none of those audiences well. You're probably a much better marketer than I am, so you could probably add some color there, but I think it's about focusing in and avoid the temptation to try and reach everybody, because that's how you can kind of overwhelm and leave everybody out.
Exactly. And what I usually tell my clients is, yes, you do have to speak to the people you serve. You have to talk to your volunteers. You have to talk to your board. But when you're doing your strategic plan, what is the goal? If the goal is we have to raise $250,000 by year end, well, then that it seems clear to me that you want to talk to people that are able to help you achieve that goal. So you can have multiple goals, but all of your audiences you need to reach can't help you get to like your fundraising goal. If you have an advocacy goal, that's a totally different audience. If you have like a let's get people to an event goal, that's different. So, you know, you might have all of these different audiences, but they can be leveraged and targeted for different goals.
Yeah, exactly. And I think you hit something on the head there. Is being audience-led is something that we really try and get nonprofits to act upon. So maybe, for example, you have a mass market audience versus a major donor audience, and you talked about that $250,000 revenue goal. Well, getting specific about who those major donors are and what's your case for support for those folks, it's going to be different actually than a mass market audience. Sometimes major donors are more sophisticated, less emotional. Sometimes they're more data driven. They want to invest in things like scale, or systems to scale. And so how you position your value proposition and your work to that audience can vary from a mass market audience that tends to be more emotionally drawn in to content. And so I think it's important to, you know, both should speak to your mission, both should speak to the work and the impact and the problem you solve, but the detail and what you include is different for each of those audiences. And it's pretty important to take the time to sit down and think about those differences.
So there's one idea in the book I wanted to talk to you about, the idea of market share, because I think this is something nonprofits, well, first of all, I disagree with it. and I disagree with the idea of donor fatigue. So the idea of market share is that there's only so much donation money available in total. But we know that the wealthiest people, the Forbes 400, they've donated less than 5% of their fortune. There's, you know, $234 billion in donor advised funds, $1.3 trillion in private foundations. So is this a problem of market share or donor fatigue, or are we just not making an effective case to donors? I mean, I think we're not making an effective case. So how can we, first of all, increase our share of these donations, but also make a more effective case?
Great question. So I think that the number that you gave, I think you said 5% of the Forbes 400 have given, 5% of their wealth has been given away, right? So I would say that is an argument that there is a finite amount of charitable giving. That's 95% of it they're not giving away.
But they could, I think, if they were convinced. So how much of it is, you're right, maybe they just are not giving it away, or how much of it is on us and we're just not making a good enough point?
Oh, I think we're in total agreement there. I think it's entirely on us as fundraisers, as nonprofit marketers, professionals, to make the case. The case I try to make in the book about market share is, at Team Rubicon, we had this crazy idea to be the best disaster relief organization in the world. We were going to outflank, outmaneuver, outposition every single person. You can't take on the American Red Cross by doing things the same way that everybody else does. You have to be hyper-competitive. And I think so many nonprofits are ran like nonprofits, and we had explosive growth because we focused on taking best-in-class for-profit methods and applying them to the nonprofit space and being competitive and thinking about, there's only so much attention out there. How do we make sure to capitalize on it?
Exactly. We live in an attention economy. There's only so much attention out there.
Yeah. So how do you grab it? How do you grab it? And I think that's really what I want to get across. You know, I mean, I'm sure you run into this all the time. Like, we have nonprofits that serve the environmental space and specifically helping to provide clean water, right? There are hundreds of nonprofits, if not thousands, that do this. And I'll talk to a nonprofit leader in like one of our free strategy calls, and they believe that they're the only ones providing clean water in the same way. And I'm like, man, I've talked to 7 people this month that are doing the exact same thing. And what would you do how would you consolidate those efforts? How would you pull those resources together? So you could take the collaborative spirit of a nonprofit, but the consolidation essence of like big business, and bring those two things together. If you take some of those tactics and you apply them to the nonprofit space, and you do that with the lens of being values driven, that is where there's like a lot of untapped potential.
So actually, this brings me to my question about the North Star and a mission statement. So is something like the North Star saying we want to be the best humanitarian organization? Is that the difference between the North Star and the mission statement?
Yeah, great question. I guess the North Star is closer to a vision, right? It's this impossible end state. It's the why we exist,
right?
Yeah, why we exist. Yeah, so at Team Rubicon, we had that idea of being the best disaster relief organization in the world. And how we did that, our mission statement, was to repurpose the skills and experience of military veterans to respond to natural disasters. But our vision was to be the best disaster relief organization in the world. And that's sort of the why. It's the big thing. And we believed that by using continued service, you could help veterans reintegrate back into civilian life. So it was renewing that sense of purpose. But what we did, you know, that was sort of, we repurposed these military veterans and the mechanics of it. That's more your mission statement versus your North Star. It's that guiding light. It's the thing that you can filter all of your ideas through. It's that thing that you can just go back to. Like right now, I'll use an example. We just spoke with an organization yesterday. Obviously, the atrocities in the Gaza Strip and Israel, it's very troubling and it's heartbreaking. And it was really interesting because one of our clients, Seeds of Peace, they operate in this space where they help to bring together Palestinians and Jews and teach them at a young age how to have conversation, have dialogue, to restore some sense of peace. And obviously this moment right now is incredibly challenging for them as an organization. And they knew they needed to act. They knew they needed to come out. They needed to take a position. And it's scary because a lot of their supporters feel like there should be stronger condemnation against Hamas. And those Palestinians think that Israel and the state of Israel is to blame for this attack.
It's incredibly fraught, emotional, polarizing, and complex.
Yeah. And so that filter, that North Star, that vision, what is the vision? And it's to restore a sense of peace and to create dialogue and to have discomfort. And so how to act and what to act and what to do, it just needs to get filtered through that lens, through that North Star. And I think that no matter your nonprofit, right, you can apply that to anything. It's like, what's our filter?
And if you have bold ideas and you have a bold North Star, you're going to hit a moment like this where it's going to be really uncomfortable. If you're working towards anything important, you're going to get pushback. You're going to get controversy. If you're doing something that's truly groundbreaking and transformative, that's going to happen. So for organizations to really embrace that North Star, keep focused on it, and just be, stay true to it, you know, fight for it and stay true to it. And you're always going to alienate someone. That's always going to be the way that it, I'm sure people, not everyone is all, you know, on board with Team Rubicon. Doesn't matter what you do. People are going to push back at your mission, and there's always going to be people that disagree with you. But if you have that and you can stand for that and stand behind it, it's going to help you in your fundraising. It's going to help you, you know, bring on new supporters.
Totally. And keep staff motivated and keep yourself grounded, you know, because obviously the nonprofit grind is hard. And so it's pretty critical, right?
So throughout the book, you say the magic happens at 10K. Can you tell us what that means?
Yeah. So we were kind of chatting about this, right? You've got people who are visionaries. They kind of set the course of the organization. They like to start projects, not finish them. And you got a lot of folks at the, you know, 1,000-foot level. They're flying at 30,000 feet. You got a lot of people at the 1,000-foot level. These are your executors. These are people who are, you know, maybe writing your donor appeals or merging contact records in Salesforce or doing the work. And what I talk about at the 10,000-foot is where ideas get turned into action. This can be done through a combination of people and process and systems. And so I think that, you know, ideas are basically shit without execution. And so you need a bridge between the vision.
That is the title of a chapter, yes.
Yeah, we like to, I think I even toned down a lot of the language in the book, but
that is the title of a chapter, though. I was like, well, that's definitely grabbing my attention.
Yeah. And it's this idea that how can you implement systems that allow ideas to be turned into action and to focus the effort? So I'll just give an example. One of my favorite ones is I used to work in finance and accounting, and it was really interesting because, like, we'd have a certain number of, we had 5 people on our team, and there'd be a certain number of days to close the month. And closing the month is really predictable in accounting. It's like, you know, you gotta like do accounts payable, accounts receivable. You gotta check all your T accounts, etc. Okay. So if it takes you, you know, 5 days to close and you have 5 people, what if you could get that down to 4 days? You just bought yourself literally 5 work days, right? And so how do you do that is you gather your team, and it's something I did at Team Rubicon, help clients with all the time, is you gather your team and you list out what are all your BAUs, your business as usual, the things that just have to happen. So merging those contact records, sending out thank you letters, acknowledgement letters, making donor phone calls, etc. What are all the BAUs? Who is the primary person responsible for those? Who is the secondary person responsible for those? And if you have only one person listed, then you have a single point of failure. And you need to close that gap. You need to identify, okay, who else can be cross-trained on this? Or do we need to hire somebody or subcontract this work out? How do we eliminate single points of failure? Then what you essentially do is you assign something that's an acceptable tolerance. So let's go back to merging contact records. Is it okay if you have 100, 500, 1,000 contacts that are potentially flagged as duplicates? Whatever that threshold for you and your organization will vary depending on its size. Could be 50. The idea is that you have your executors, the people at a 1,000-foot level, focusing on their BAUs until the acceptable tolerance. Then you go back to that project backlog and you say, okay, our BAUs are stable. What's on the project backlog that has that priority one, that's high impact, low effort? I'm going to start working through those P1 projects. And now you can kind of see the magic of 10,000 foot is where these systems come together, and you're taking an idea that's set by the visionary at 30,000 foot, and you're leveraging systems in order to focus people at the 1,000 foot level who love finishing things but don't like starting them and don't really know how to prioritize. So it gives you something to work with.
I love that, because I love very tactical, practical, step-by-step instructions. And certainly that is in the book as well. So I think that's really helpful. You're kind of like giving us your secret sauce. So thank you for that. So we need to talk about how we can get buy-in for bold ideas. So what are some ways that nonprofit leaders can convince, say, like their boards to even just start thinking about bold ideas or to implement bold ideas?
Super important to get stakeholder buy-in. And a way to get stakeholder buy-in at every level of the organization is a feeling of inclusion. People don't like to be necessarily told what to do. They like to feel like they've been a part of the decision-making process. So how we go about this at like a board level is we facilitate a lot of board retreats, and we bring together the board. And there's a certain responsibility from the executive director or CEO to kind of the leader of the organization to say, at a big level, this is where the stake is in the sand. This is where we're headed. But how can we be a higher functioning board in order to help achieve that? How can we focus our energy, our time, our talent? Because have you served on any boards?
Yes, actually, I've served on quite a few. And right now I'm on the school board. So not a traditional nonprofit board, but we do have to be tactical and practical, but we do also have to be visionaries too.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, like boards are filled with well-intending people who have busy lives.
Lots of different personalities.
So, you know, going through an exercise of like, how might we be a higher functioning board, and getting people to identify specific steps that they can take and milestones that can be achieved, allow you to build out kind of a timeline of these things called drumbeats that essentially are these moments that happen throughout the year. And then, okay, people work better in pairs. So having those people pair up and identify what are specific steps that can be taken, that dual accountability is super critical, because accountability is one of the challenges at a board level. And so we find that by pairing people up to hold each other accountable, it turns ideas into action. So by making sure that like you share the one-page strategic plan with your board, and then you say, okay, what's our role in it? As board members, how can we help make this successful? And being vulnerable and expressing when you need support from the board and when you don't is super important. So I think an inclusive process is how you get buy-in from people. That's the work that we do when we're facilitating these board retreats. It's really around creating that inclusive space. I think that's pretty important.
I love that idea of pairing board members up. I never even thought of that. I've always thought of boards functioning on committees, but actually that gives me a really great idea even just for the school board, because people cycle in and some of us have been on it for a very long time. Some of us have just started. I mean, there's election cycles every year. So we don't do that. We have an orientation and then the chair calls the new board members. But to pair us up, I think would be really powerful. And it's not violating like open meeting law or violating any laws just to have two board members talking. And I feel like other board members, for a nonprofit example, they wouldn't feel left out. And then they can present to the full committee something they'd been noodling on.
How long is your school board term?
3 years.
Okay. Yeah. So it also helps, right, with onboarding faster, because you kind of described like this onboarding process, and it helps to buddy up in that sense too, so people can get an understanding faster and get to work. So yeah, I hadn't really thought about that either. So I appreciate that. That helps me as well think about that.
Yeah. And it's also helpful to new board members. I'm just thinking now of the budgeting process. We're doing the budgeting process and boards all do budgeting. I've been on the school committee for about, I can't even believe it's been like 4 years now, I think. 4 or 5 years. And I still learn from the budgeting process. I still go to budgeting 101. I still do all of that. And I think it's helpful for board members, no matter how long they've been serving, to still be able to have access to these welcoming resources that the other board members have. But then even just having that culture, building that culture where these ideas are embraced and, you know, not shut down immediately, I think is helpful. It's much easier said than done, of course. How did you do it at Team Rubicon? Or even just at the supervisory level? Does it have to be led by the higher ups in order to work?
Yeah, so we invested heavily in regular meeting time. So by that I mean structured meetings, so not completely unstructured time. That's pretty much a waste of time. That's a good way to discourage people. Essentially what we did was we had a leadership conference. So Team Rubicon was primarily volunteer led, but volunteers were treated like full-time staff in that they had job titles, they had job descriptions, they had clear objectives. They were included in the process of identifying what's working, what's not working, what's not clear about what we're doing. And so we would gather as a leadership team once a year and at a national level, bringing together all of the volunteer leaders and the staff. And we would go through about a 3 or 4 day leadership meeting where we would paint an idea of what the vision is for the organization. And then we would talk, we would include them on how we're going to make this happen. And we would do retros, which really we call after action reports, which is something out of the military. We would produce these reports based on conversation and dialogue about what's working and not. So it's really similar to what I described at the board level. It's just an inclusive process using structured exercises to get people contributing to the path forward.
Fantastic. Wonderful. I know people are going to want to be in contact with you. They're going to want to get the book. So where can they reach you, connect with you, and get the book?
Yeah, well, first, I just want to do a shout out first before I give away that and say you do incredible work and I love what you're doing in the space. So I think if you're a nonprofit looking for some marketing suggestions or tips and execution, Julia is amazing and you can catch her at all these conferences. So I just want to make that plug.
Yay. Well, yeah, words of affirmation.
Perfect.
I love language.
Yeah. Well, you can find me and find the book as well as a bunch of other free resources that we give away to nonprofits at causemic.com, causemic.com. And you can also find me on LinkedIn, Matt Scott, 2 T's all around. And happy to. You can get a free copy of the book. We'll send you a copy. And there's a lot of other good stuff on there too.
Great. Well, Matt, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you. I really appreciated our conversation. And thanks for putting all the work into making this podcast come to life. I know it's not easy. So thank you.
Well, hey there. I wanted to say thank you for tuning into my show and for listening all the way to the end. If you really enjoyed today's conversation, make sure to subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast app and you'll get new episodes downloaded as soon as they come out. I would love if you left me a rating or a review, because this tells other people that my podcast is worth listening to. And then me and my guests can reach even more earbuds and create even more impact. So that's pretty much it. I'll be back soon with a brand new episode. But until then, you can find me on Instagram at JuliaCampbell77. Keep changing the world, you nonprofit unicorn.